Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does a secure border look like? And is that a realistic goal for the nearly 2,000-mile divide between the United States and Mexico? Author David J. Dinello was aware of the problems of drug smuggling and illegal immigration and of the proposed solutions, including a 700-mile fence between the two countries. But he wanted to see for himself how the border operates right now, so he took 3 months to get from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific Ocean, moving back and forth from the U.S. to Mexico along the border as he went. He writes about what he discovered in his new book called The Border, Exploring the U.S.-Mexican Divide. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's an honor to be on your program.
A big takeaway from this, I think, for people who don't know the border well, is that this is not a uniform dividing line. Will you talk about how different the border and its people are from one place to the next?
Well, you know, the border, it's that's a tough question to capture because it's something I could write a book on.
Which you did.
In summary, I would say that the difference between Southeast Texas and northeastern Mexico is a wide sea change from the San Diego-Tijuana line. Capturing the whole narrative of the way that people on the border think from one side to the other, the best way to understand it is to understand the difference between a river and a line in the sand. A river is a body of water. You know, it invites cooperation. Both sides have to use it. In South Texas, the majority of the water flow that comes out of the Rio Grande, or the Rio Bravo as it's known in Mexico, actually begins in the Rio Conchos, which is a river in Mexico. That can be a metaphor for the mindset that most civic leaders tend to take on that part of the border is dealing with civic cooperation. In many cities on that part of the border, there have been agreements negotiated with the Border Patrol, in particular one between Eagle Pass and Piedras Negras, where emergency services can even respond to crises on other sides in time of need. This was put to the test in April 2007 and was very effective when tornadoes hit Piedras Negras and Eagle Pass at the same time. Not so on the western part of the border. A much more tense border. There's very real issues for that. The smuggling it certainly exists throughout the border, but it's much stronger and much more violent in the Arizona and California regions in particular. Of the incursions from the Mexican military that have occurred on the border, known whether they were actually members of the Mexican military is debatable. It's more likely that those incursions were conducted by members of cartels in Mexican military uniform. But of the 210 that were known to have occurred from 2003 on, 186 of those happened from El Paso to the west. So you have a much more tense part of the border on that portion to the west.
You write that when you got to El Paso, things really changed distinctly, and all of a sudden you'd come to this thing that you call the angry border.
Well, I describe it that way, not to poke a finger in the eye of El Paso or Juarez, which is a very large and diverse community, but to frame for the reader that, you know, there's a lot of cooperation that's existing, and then you have this huge stretch of empty border, and then El Paso is really where the issues first begin to be manifest. I spent a lot of time in downtown El Paso, which is almost it's almost an extension of northern Juarez at this point. El Paso is a diverse area. There are a lot of different regions, Fort Bliss, some of the southern suburbs as well. And Juarez is a very dangerous area right now. Mexican troops have been deployed there since March of 2008. Taking initiative against cartel violence.
You actually went down to Juarez, I guess, once President Calderon deployed those troops to see what it was like. Can you talk about what that experience was like?
The border right now is the most violent place in North America, and I didn't walk around and hear gunshots every night or anything like that, but there was an overt police presence. There were sirens. There was an overt military presence. I did hear sporadic gunfire at periods of time and read reports of fighting throughout the weekend. I was in there the second weekend the troops were deployed. But you know, a lot of it was occurring transparent to the businesses that continue to operate in the area. There's still large volumes of trade that push north from Juarez. The maquilas are still running, and that same weekend it was kind of a bizarre juxtaposition. There was an international youth soccer tournament that was taking place in Juarez in the midst of all this all this other activity. One of the things that I've grown to realize is really how little we know about the 40,000 troops that are deployed throughout Mexico. The Mexican military is doing a lot of things, Calderon has taken a very aggressive stand against the cartels. But we really don't have a clear grasp of what they're doing, other than we know that they're flowing back and forth from different areas, kind of surging troops from place to place. We know that 76% of the Mexicans support Calderon's initiatives, but over 60% believe that he's losing. And all evidence seems to suggest that the cartels are going to be able to weather the storm. We know that that Calderon is staking his presidency on his initiatives against the cartels. It's unknown how that will turn out or whether there will be any enduring success.
And I guess the presence of those Mexican troops, federal troops, is forcing the police in a lot of these border regions to sort of operate as an odd third wheel, in some ways a go-between between the cartels and the military that are there to stop them.
Well, the local law enforcement have always been in the worst situation. The mayors and the chiefs of police are often the first to get killed in these scenarios, and they're faced with the infamous choice of plata o plomo, as it's said, and that's silver or lead. So take the bribe or take a bullet. I write about a man who was a business leader and became fed up with violence in Nuevo Laredo and asked to be sworn in as mayor on June 8th of 2005, made a very public declaration. His name was Alejandro Dominguez, and he was killed within 8 hours. The situation has stabilized from that period of time in Nuevo Laredo, but those are the sorts of events that often become the norm for the local leaders. Is they're stuck choosing between the sides.
Now, the reason that all this drug trade is clustered along the border is because the vast majority of what it's producing flows into the United States for consumption. Can you talk about U.S. drug interdiction efforts and how they coordinate with Mexican drug interdiction efforts?
You know, Chris, I can't in detail right now because I know one thing is that it has changed since the war in Iraq. Funding for drug interdiction efforts on the North American continent has decreased by 72% since 2003. Now, that's a statistic that I know is a government statistic. I don't know if that's Department of Defense, DEA, FBI. I can't break that out for you, but I know that the report that I read indicated that the U.S. government investment in North American drug interdiction had decreased as a whole by 72%. So what we know is they're not doing as much as they used to. We know that the drug routes not only are profitable along the border, but obviously their drugs are flown in, they're shipped in, and there's myriads of ways that that illegal drugs come into the United States. Where we're at on that, it's anybody's guess at this point.
David J. Dinello is my guest. His book is called The Border, Exploring the U.S.-Mexican Divide. What do we know or what can be speculated about the drugs that go across the regular borders, very often in large trucks or secreted away in other kinds of vehicles, as opposed to those that are pushed across the border in places where there are no checkpoints?
One generality that we can move forward with is that generally marijuana is sort of a mom and pop operation. over half of the marijuana that's consumed in the United States is actually produced in the United States, and Canada has its own marijuana growing regions. So south of our border, the marijuana that comes over is often packed. It's usually carried by men who are referred to as mules, who are often working off debts or enslaved in some other capacity, and put to work. The big money is obviously in the cocaine, in the heroin, in the meth, and that comes over in the plazas. It's shipped through the major ports of entry, so Nuevo Laredo into Laredo, where 10,000 trucks a day come through I-35. As I'm sure you know, Chris, over 90% of the trucks that come through that port of entry are not inspected. And so cartels just stack the deck, and they push cargo through, and they'll get caught sometimes, but there's enough product and enough profit that they can eventually make their way north.
Well, you know, people hear a statistic like that. I should say El Paso is my hometown, so I'm familiar with that, and I worked there as a reporter for years. People hear a number like 90% are not inspected, and they're up in arms. But let's talk about the realities of the rest of the honest and legal trade and how that would be affected if someone were to decide that every single vehicle had to be inspected fully before it got across.
Oh, sure. It would be a tremendous... It would slow the rate of the significant economic investment that's been made, and the explosion that's occurred in trade. 40% of the goods that are consumed east of the Mississippi come through the port of Laredo. There's such an immense tie between the United States and Mexico in terms of the trade connectivity that you can't wave a magic wand and say, well, we're going to take a hard line here and inspect every vehicle. You could. It's an option. I shouldn't say you can't. But if you choose to do that, there would be significant economic consequences.
And for goods flowing the other direction, Texas exports more to Mexico than any other U.S. state.
That's correct.
My guest is David J. Dinello. His book is called The Border, Exploring the U.S.-Mexican Divide. Can you talk a little bit about how border residents tend to interact with each other and relate to people on the other side?
I think that also varies from place to place on the border. I think there's a difference between the way that border residents in the north and the south relate. Obviously, you have, having grown up in El Paso, you've seen families connected and friends on both sides of the line. Some places I observed in the border in the south, there is tremendous resentment and sadness because, for example, in Nogales, Arizona, there's a tremendous change that's taken place in the dynamic of Nogales over the past 15 years as a result of the many deportations from the United States into Mexico. When an illegal immigrant is deported from the United States into Mexico, they're just dropped off.
David J. Dinello is my guest. He's a journalist whose new book is called The Border, Exploring the U.S.-Mexican Divide. We'll talk more about the book and the issues it raises after this break. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Up next, we'll talk about the challenges and responsibilities of the U.S. Border Patrol.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. David J. DiNello is my guest. He's a journalist and former Marine whose new book is called The Border, Exploring the U.S.-Mexican Divide. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about the Border Patrol. It has been around for a century and a half, although its initial purpose was keeping out Chinese immigrants?
That's correct. And alcohol during Prohibition.
And it's evolved certainly today into a much broader function. What kinds of resources are available to the Border Patrol?
In terms of?
Well, I mean, they have a certain amount of technology that they're able to use when they can't have a human being in every spot along the border that they want to keep secure.
The Border Patrol and the Department of Homeland Security has adopted a sort of strategic triad that they move forward with, and almost anything that you ever read about the border and about border security will deal with one of these three categories. Their triad is personnel, technology, and infrastructure, and that's their three areas of operation, their avenues of approach for securing the border. The Border Patrol has about 18,000 personnel right now on duty. At any given time, about 6,000 of those are on duty on the northern and southern border. You can take that from, if they have 18,000 officers, then in any organization generally that's affiliated with law enforcement, you've got about a third of your force on duty, a third off duty, and a third asleep, and that's your rotation cycle. So you have about 6,000 well-trained men and women who are observing the border to deter against illegal incursions. Supporting that is various levels of technology, sensors, cameras, radar, air assets, aerostat balloons, myriads of forms of technology that are used to detect illegal entry, and then infrastructure is everything from the Rio Grande itself, which is the deterrent, to fences, which are an ongoing topic of debate.
We'll talk about fences in just a moment, but there have been some proposals to widen the Rio Grande because in some places it's this big sort of roaring thing, and in other places it's a trickle that you could hop across without getting your pants wet.
Well, couple of things about the Rio Grande that's important to understand. First, the Rio Grande actually doesn't start in the United States. I know it does on the map, and I know that the line that we've drawn takes us from Colorado all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. The Spanish actually had three different names for three different rivers, and they were correct, because the larger flow rate that supplies the Rio Grande begins in Mexico in a river called the Rio Conchos that starts in the western Sierra Madres. And so east of Presidio and Ojinaga, the flow rate really picks up for the Rio Grande, and it picks up even more east of the Pecos and then as we move southeast. So the initiatives to widen the Rio Grande are mostly down in the Brownsville and Laredo area, and those are, I think, probably more practical, of more practical value for infrastructure than an actual fence would be in those areas.
And there are continuing debates on both sides about who should have water, both in the Rio Grande and other sort of tributaries that flow in and around it.
There are. There's a 1944 agreement that's been signed that there was a challenge in the late 1990s in early 2000 that Mexico was not living up to their end of the bargain. Releasing the flow rate from the Conchos, they amended. Texas and Mexico came to an agreement after the state of Texas threatened to sue Mexico for their failure to release the water. They came to an agreement. The flow rate has been modified, and for the past 3 years, the water has flowed at a strong rate.
Let's talk about the wall. 700 miles is the proposed distance that this would stretch. What kind of structure are we thinking of here?
Well, first, to talk about the fence, we have to talk about the Secure Fence Act that was passed in 2006. The legislation mandates 700 miles of what's called sandia fencing, which is a large 20-foot high mesh wire fence topped with barbed wire, 150-meter stretch where vehicles can drive, and then a second fence that mirrors the first one. That's taken from Sandia National Laboratories, which developed the structure to secure several energy facilities, but then also it was used during Operation Gatekeeper in 1994 in San Diego, and that's the fence that was built in there. The 700 miles of fencing that are supposed to be put in were mandated to be put in on all the urban areas because, for reasons unknown to me, the negotiators of that bill felt that that was a necessary event to create on each urban area on the U.S.-Mexico border because it had been effective in San Diego. The Secure Fence Act does not appear to account for the tactical reality that the river of the Rio Grande is itself an obstacle. The actual U.S.-Mexico border runs down the middle of the Rio Grande. And one of the interesting conversations I had with a lot of Border Patrol agents off the record, because, of course, they don't want to talk about this, you know, on the record, but they would just say, hey, why don't you guys just give us some boats? And, you know, most of the illegal crossings take place, they're swimming or floating across the Rio Grande, and, you know, they would be happy to patrol the river itself if they were supplied with enough shallow water boats to do so. And the other issue along the Rio Grande is this weed called the carrizo cane. It proliferates like kudzu along both sides of the river. When you've looked at the pictures in the book, of course, Chris, and you can see, you know, if you go down there, of course, you can see how this is about a 20 to 30 meter stretch on both sides of the river that's densely proliferated with this stuff. It's a non-invasive plant, or it's a non-native plant. It's invasive from the 18th century of Mediterranean ships that brought over roofing materials, and it just proliferated along the Rio Grande. It's one of the few things that environmentalists in the Department of Homeland Security agree about. Everybody wants this stuff out, but they've had a difficult time getting rid of it. It just grows back very quickly. What they've found is that there's a beetle that's native to the Mediterranean that when you cut this plant down to the roots and seed it with this beetle, the beetle eats it and the roots die. So right now, the Department of Homeland Security, and I'm not making this up, has invested $11.2 million in beetle breeding to get rid of the carrizo and is partnered with the Environmental Protection Agency.
Do we know what else the beetle eats? Is it going to come along and chew up lawns?
I'm not sure. To my knowledge, as the reading that I've done on this, which is very limited, there's a scholar in McAllen whom I have not met personally, who I know is, according to public record, is working on this. But he says that the beetle does not pose a threat to other species.
There are some opponents of the idea of putting up a fence, including some who speak off the record sometimes from within the Border Patrol, who say putting a fence up in urban areas is all well and good, but what you do is push people who are still inclined to cross out into areas that are much more dangerous to human life.
Well, that's the big topic of debate out west in San Diego is whether the fence that was put in San Diego and Tijuana pushed everybody into the desert regions of Arizona. That's a conventional belief. There's another variable that I think is interesting to look at when I've looked at this issue. The U.S. military was regularly involved with counter-drug efforts along the border from 1989 until 1997. The death of Ezequiel Hernandez Jr. In Redford, Texas, meant that there are still military missions that continue along the border. From there's air support that's flown for Border Patrol, Air National Guard, those sorts of things. But ground troops on the border conducting counter drug patrols and training with the Border Patrol and those sorts of things. That hasn't occurred.
Let me stop you for a minute. Let's remind people about Ezequiel Hernandez. He was a goat herder who was a teenage boy and was shot by Marines?
That's correct. That event took place on May 20th, 1997.
So that essentially stopped that level of involvement by the Marines in protecting the border from drug trade.
It did, but what's important to understand, and we can get back to talking about the what happened there in a second, but what's important to understand about that from a security standpoint is that most of the missions that had taken place from 1989 to 1997 took place west of El Paso. And the reason for that is that most of the land that's on the border west of El Paso is federally owned land, particularly in Arizona. You have a large tribal reservation. You've got several national parks. You've got most of your land there is federally owned, so it was much easier for the military to access that. There were a series of reasons why the Marines were on patrol in Texas. It was a series of accidents and bad decisions that had taken place. But most of the land in Texas along the border is privately owned. So the Border Patrol works with local law enforcement, local ranchers, to get a sense of what ranches, you know, have smugglers and who might be, you know, doing illicit things on their property. You had a situation in 1997, getting back to your earlier point about, you know, fences pushing people out west. When you examine the statistics of when the traffic really shot up in Arizona, it coincides with the same amount of time when the military was pulled off of the border. And that really created a vulnerability as well. So I think a lot of what pushed people out into the desert was a combination of the fences being built, and then there was a perfect storm that the smugglers and coyotes said, "Hey, we got an opportunity now," because all these counter drug missions that had been taking place, now they're gone.
And of course, there are people who will argue, "Well, these people are crossing illegally, and so if they're out in the desert and taking this risk, they've accepted that." But the truth is that our Border Patrol agents are out there, sort of helping and protecting the ones who get caught.
That's absolutely true. I think that the Border Patrol agents perform, you know, brave and very humane and unheralded feats on a daily basis, particularly in the southwestern border. The Border Patrol is divided into 9 sectors on the southwest. 5 of those are in Texas. El Paso covers New Mexico as well. And then there's 4 sectors, Tucson, Yuma, El Centro, and San Diego, that cover Arizona and California. The Tucson sector has over 45% of the illegal incursion, or of the apprehensions that occur on the entire southwestern border. So that sector itself has been really a war zone since the mid-90s. And that's something that Border Patrol agents are stuck right in the middle of dealing with, the humanitarian crisis and the legal and ethical and security challenges.
So we've talked about the Border Patrol. We've talked about some military presence along the border. The fact that it's not everywhere has led to the rise of this group called the Minutemen. And you had some encounters with them during your travels. Can you talk a little bit about them?
You know, the Minutemen are an interesting group. And in the book, I paralleled the Minutemen with a humanitarian group that called Los Samaritanos, where they're both populated, in my observation, by passionate idealists. And, you know, I am sure that on some level of the Minutemen organization, there are racial dimensions, and there are racists that certainly may be affiliated with the Minutemen. But as an organization and the leadership of the organization, I did not find them driven by racism so much as idealism. A fervent, almost messianic belief that they have to be out there doing something to secure the border. And that same emotional drive was present in the Samaritan groups, the Los Samaritanos and Inmigrantes Sans Sin Fronteras. And they're passionate about their devotion to humanity. And so the Franciscan friar who runs that group, named Brother David Buer, is out there on an ongoing basis looking for migrants to rescue and to aid if they ask for help if they ask to be turned into the Border Patrol, which they sometimes do because they're exhausted, the friar will do that. Otherwise, the only difference between Brother Buer and Chris Simcox, the president of the Minutemen, in terms of how they operate on the border, is that, you know, one group turns them into the Border Patrol and the other doesn't.
You're a big proponent of the idea that in order for the borders to be really secure, both Mexico and the U.S. have to make this a national priority. Does the priority in one country supersede that in the other?
Well, I'm a proponent of that view just by evaluating the different options and you know, spending so much time on the border, you have the opportunity to think, you know, about what we could do one way or another. And we really have three options as we move forward from developing a national policy about the border issues. And the first option is to keep doing what we're doing right now, is to keep adding more personnel, to keep adding more technology, to keep adding more infrastructure. The problem with that option is we really have no evidence that it would work. We don't have any real bellwether to see, well, it hasn't worked up until this point, and there's really no reason to believe that if we just keep piling all this stuff on, that it's really going to solve the issues or deal with the issues in the way that we want to provide an enduring solution. Your second option is, of course, to militarize the border completely, and that wouldn't be just adding personnel. That would be, you know, you'd weaponize the border, put claymores, put machine guns, put, you know, restrict your trade and essentially treat Mexico as an enemy nation. I don't think that that's an economically viable option. I don't think that's a culturally viable option. And I just really don't think that that's where America is in its relationship with Mexico, which leads to the third option, which we can talk more about.
Yes, thank you for teasing that ahead. We will get the third option after the break. My guest is David J. DiNello. His book is called The Border, Exploring the U.S.-Mexican Divide. If you want to be part of the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist David J. DiNello. His book is called The Border, Exploring the U.S.-Mexican Divide. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372. So you were going to give us the third option for securing the border.
I'll preface this third option by my background as a pragmatist. As you know from reading the book, Chris, I'm not affiliated with, you know, with any political angle in the border issues, and before I was a journalist, I served as a Marine officer and deployed to Iraq and served a tour and left the Marine Corps and wrote a book about Marines in Iraq, which was the start of my journalism career. And so, because of that, I'm inclined to think in terms of partnerships and of partnerships in improbable situations. I know in 2004, when I was in Iraq, you know, very few people were talking as seriously as they should have been at the time about the kinds of partnerships that we could create with the Iraqi people and with Iraqi security forces. People were obviously discussing it, but it wasn't a part of the policy conversation. Now, fast forward to today, and we've seen a number of effective solutions on the tactical level that have worked in partnership with Iraq, where, you know, the conversation in 2004 was, those guys are just corrupt, we can't work with them, it's, you know, that'll never happen, and, well, lo and behold, we made it work. So when I look across the border into Mexico, I'll tell you about a situation I had in Brownsville with a Border Patrol agent named Walter King. Was on a ride along with Agent King, and This is in the Rio Grande Valley sector of the Border Patrol. And we're driving along the border. We look over and we see this shiny red pickup truck with these two guys that are staring at a sensor with binoculars and looking at us. And then one guy's got the driver has a notepad. Obviously, they're a reconnaissance outfit for some coyotes. So we stop and we look at them and they look at us, and they're about, oh, I'd say 50. I mean, the river's about 75 meters wide there, and so.
Did you say coyotes are human smugglers?
They're human smugglers, and we don't. I mean, we don't know. We in that area, it would. They probably are both, but we just know that these guys are looking at us, and so we stop and get out, and I pull out my camera, and then they immediately drive away. But I snapped a couple of pictures of them before they took off. And I looked over at Agent King and I said, "So, is there anybody on the other side who you can call to give that information to?" And he said, "Oh no, of course not. Those are all the Mexicans." And I said, "Well, let's assume for a second that we had trust partnerships on the other side that existed. Is there any legal framework that exists for you to be able to work with law enforcement on the other side on your level?" And he said, "No, there's really not, on an immediate tactical level." And I think that's an issue. I think that, you know, obviously there's an ongoing question of how effective a partnership with Mexico on the tactical level could be, because there is these endemic corruption issues that we addressed earlier in the program. But by the same token, I've personally met with a number of Mexican military officials who are deployed doing very brave work. The Attorney General of the state of Coahuila has been threatened with death 5 times from the cartels, and he's still in office, and he's still still prosecuting, and still he has a protection detail, but he's still hard at work. And I think that it's important to sort of validate the legitimate partners that we have in Mexico and find ways to work with them.
And that might include, in your opinion, providing them with more technology, more funding.
I don't know so much about technology and funding. We have passed a bill in Congress called the Merida Initiative, which is a 3-year, $1.4 billion aid package. That started funding to Mexico this year in thirds, $550 million, excuse me, a year. Most of that funding is already allocated towards aviation assets. About 85% of the funding is for UAVs and helicopters for the Mexican military to use. Certainly, that's useful. But really, what needs to be addressed is the human element. Let me give you an example, and before I give this, I need to say this is not something I'm advocating as an immediate solution for the U.S.-Mexico border. But in the European Union, the way that the open border environment is governed is it's structured with a security agreement where there are hot pursuit clauses. So, for example, there's information sharing required, there's radio frequency sharing required. Let's say a French criminal speeds from France into Germany. Well, the French police will, throw on their sirens, chase him, call the Germans on the German radio frequencies, have the German police set up their roadblocks, and they'll, pursue the cop or pursue the criminal straight into Germany. And that level of trust is actually mandated in these open border agreements, anywhere from 10 to 50 kilometers between countries, depending on their size. And volume of traffic and other things. Now, again, we're not in a position where we can snap our fingers right now and do that with Mexico. I recognize that. But we have to determine whether we're going to treat Mexico as a partner or an adversary. That's really a binary choice. And there is a huge element of gray area in there. I recognize that as well as anyone. But when you get down to where you come down on that, and you have to make that choice, you really have to drive towards finding the partnerships, I think, if we want to move forward with a more productive relationship with Mexico as the 21st century unfolds.
I realize that you are speaking in a sort of a theoretical way about this, but I wonder if you worry that the kind of drug violence that right now plagues the southern side of the border far more than it does the northern side would also sort of move across the border if we open things up a little bit, even with something as simple as a hot pursuit clause.
Well, I think that the violence is as lethal in many places on the northern side as it is on the southern. It's just not recognized or openly discussed. We don't have we don't have 40,000 troops deployed throughout the United States that are dealing with cartel violence, but we do have NYPD in New York, LAPD in throughout Los Angeles, and gang units that that deal with this kind of violence throughout the country in urban areas on an ongoing basis. We know that the enemy that the Mexican troops are combating is very well networked on both sides of the border. Many of the troops, for lack of a better expression, in the cartels, the associates, your mid-level managers, actually get their training in American prisons, and they're recruited there. They go through a sort of informal boot camp, and they're also required to read Sun Tzu, many of them. There's an unofficial training program that exists in the University of Sinaloa, where, according to an American journalist named Alan Wall, over one-third of the faculty of the University of Sinaloa is directly affiliated with the cartels. They take classes in business management, in finance, in accounting, to better construct and beef up their business model. So I think the expression spillover is spurious. I think it's a continental issue. This is a North American issue. Drug smuggling, illegal immigration. Mexico has as much issues with illegal immigration as the United States does. They have heavily militarized their southern border with Guatemala. So these are issues that, although each country deals with it differently, the issues themselves are going to be with us for some time to come.
Is it useful, even for framing the way we look at this, to call it a war on drugs?
I don't think so.
Why not?
I think that the term war, when we talk about war on cancer, when we talk about war on drugs, connotates that there are not other solutions. That conversations about dealing with the drug issue have to include demand, have to include treatment, have to include prevention, have to include, there's a broader picture that has to be, and I say this as a former Marine, there are some things that just don't have military solutions. And so I would prefer to reserve the expression war for things that require military solutions. I think that when we talk about smugglers and cartels, I describe in Mexico the idea that the Mexican government is dealing with a counterinsurgency, and I say that not because these guys that we're dealing against are themselves insurgents. They're not trying to overthrow the government. But they do challenge the legitimacy of the government with their illegal business model. And as that is systemic, the longer that's sustained, the less legitimate the government becomes, which is why Calderon has attacked it so head-on. Sustaining the legitimacy of the governments, that's a term that the Pentagon has grown to use the term hybrid war or counterinsurgency, and I think that that's more useful for thinking about it, because I think the term war on drugs just becomes a cliche.
We do have time for a quick phone call, and that's Derek in Dallas. Hello, Derek.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just would like to say, firstly, that I appreciate all this firsthand information that that you've been able to provide us with the situation on the border and the situation in northern Mexico. And I appreciate your perspective on the cartel and all the violence that occurs there. But it would seem to me that one of the logical things to do to undermine the power of the cartel and to actually take away their legitimacy to exist would be to legalize or at least to some degree, decriminalize maybe personal drug possession or something like that. And I'm sure you've thought of that in the course of your research. I'd just like to know what you think about that.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
In 1972, the Nixon administration, this is the Nixon administration, commissioned a study on national drug use, and it recommended that marijuana be decriminalized under federal, state, and local law immediately. Unfortunately, that happened just prior to Watergate, so Nixon didn't really have much political momentum to move forward with that. The Ford administration rejected it, and it really hasn't been a topic of conversation since then. I think that that's, it would be interesting to see what a new commission and what a new study that was done with executive authority would recommend.
I know that you've done some work, David, on consulting on border security. Can you talk a little bit about who your clients are and what it is they want to know?
No.
you can't tell me.
The consulting work's all confidential. I can't.
Okay. Well, you should probably take it out of your bio. But
I think that they want to know in many ways a lot of the same things that we all do, but they want to know it for protecting their own assets.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think the future lies? Is it going to get worse before it gets better, or are we starting to figure out the right way to handle border security?
I think it's an open-ended question. I think it's going to be, the Mexican political cycle is very interesting. Mexican elections one every 6 years, and presidents are restricted to one term in office only. So in 2012, Calderon will be done. Somebody new will be in power. We don't know who. They could be interested in maintaining this partnership that Calderon has reached out to. Not only has he been taking on the cartels aggressively, but he's also reached out to the United States for assistance in much more tangible ways than previous Mexican presidents did. His first act when he was in office was to extradite 15 cartel leaders to the United States, where we had been requesting their prosecution, and that sent a very direct message to the cartels that the Mexican president wasn't going to mess around. I think that as the issue moves forward, the political cycle in Mexico will drive the degree of productivity between the United States and Mexico on dealing with the issue. And there's going to be a myriad of social issues and cultural issues that drive the conversation as well. It will be interesting to see how it unfolds in the 21st century.
David J. Dinello's newest book is called The Border, Exploring the U.S.-Mexican Divide. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. I really...
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.